Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, next case we have on calendar. Last case we have on calendar is docket number 6899, Grace versus District Court. Mr. O'Brien, you ready?
Yes, Justice.
All right, come on up.
Good afternoon, Justice. May it please the Court, my name is Robert O'Brien. I represent Petitioner LaCorey Grace in this matter. At this time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
The question in front of this Court today is simply whether justice courts have inherent authority to determine legal evidence at a preliminary hearing. The answer to the question is also simply yes. That authority is contained in their jurisdiction to conduct preliminary hearings. That authority has been recognized in Nevada statutes creating a remedy for the prosecutor or the state when justice courts rule to suppress evidence, and the legislature has refused to restrict that authority on at least two separate occasions. Turning to the question of the inherent authority to begin with, this court has on several occasions reminded attorneys that justice courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. However, in State v. Justice Court, this court also expressed the opinion that that authority can either be express or inherent. In this case, we are discussing inherent authority or inherent authority under the jurisdiction to conduct preliminary hearings. The Nevada legislature, based on two Nevada statutes, has asked justice courts or granted justice courts the jurisdiction to conduct preliminary hearings to determine if there is probable cause to hold a defendant in Nevada for trial.
Does inherent authority include credibility of witnesses also?
Yes, Your Honor. In Goldsmith, this court discussed legal and competent evidence and the restrictions that a justice court judge must determine whether evidence is legal and competent before allowing the state to admit it at a preliminary hearing. In the same way, credibility of the witnesses, while generally an issue for trial, there are instances where credibility would come into account. If a witness were to take the stand and say, in a robbery case, well, I thought it was the defendant, but actually it was a space alien, in that instance, the justice court judge would be weighing the credibility of the witness in determining whether or not there's probable cause to bind the matter over.
Is there any case authority about credibility as far as justice courts concerned preliminary hearings?
There is, Your Honor. In general, the court has restricted credibility, weighings of credibility as an issue for a jury. But there are extreme examples, one such as the hypothetical I just mentioned, where a justice court would, of course, take into consideration the credibility. In general, however, credibility, by precedent from this court, is a matter for the jury trial. So, however, credibility is different than the inherent jurisdiction here to weigh legal and competent evidence. That evidence code requires that justice court judges weigh the admissibility of evidence. Contained within NRS 48.025 is the requirement that that judges also determine and make sure that illegal or unconstitutional evidence is not admitted, that it is inadmissible under Nevada evidence code. And that evidence code does apply to all stages of proceedings per the legislature's mandate in NRS 47.020. At heart, the question of legality of evidence is where the inherent authority comes from. In determining legal evidence, or what is illegal evidence, the court is weighing whether or not the evidence may be admitted at the preliminary hearing. There is no difference in this question of illegal evidence because it was illegally obtained by a state actor. And in that, the Nevada legislature, while not granting express authority to the justice courts to hear motions to suppress, has recognized that it is common practice in the justice courts in Nevada to address questions of legality and suppression.
And in fact, has that not been the subject of at least two attempts by and through the legislature to take away that authority?
It has, Justice Sata. In 2007 and 2015, the Prosecutors Association for Nevada attempted to have lobby to have a statute restrict the authority of the justice courts to hear suppression motions and the constitutionality of evidence when weighing whether or not the evidence is legal. On both occasions, the legislature declined. They refused the request to restrict the justice court's authority. And I think that's perhaps one of the most important points here, because after two attempts to try to get the legislature to change the way justice courts practice in the state of Nevada, the Prosecutors Association failed. And yet the state of Nevada is here today asking this court to grant them the remedy that the legislature would not. It's essentially an end around the legislative process. The legislature, in denying that request on two different occasions, is in effect recognizing the inherent jurisdiction that comes out of the authority to conduct preliminary hearings, saying, we know that it's common practice for justice courts to conduct suppression hearings. And in 2007, Judge Dahl specifically discussed the common practice of justice court judges. He was speaking on behalf of the Nevada Judges Association, and he made a point of letting the legislature know that what the Prosecutors Association was asking for was not a mere procedural change, but it was a substantive change. In fact, I'd characterize it as a radical reorganization of Nevada's courts. Because if the legislature were to have limited justice courts and prohibited them from addressing this question, they would be diminishing the authority and legitimacy of the justice court judges.
Can I ask you one question?
Yes, Justice.
And I'm pondering. NRS 189-120 actually allows the state to appeal to the district court from an order of the justice court granting a motion of a defendant to suppress evidence. Can you talk about that? Why is that statute necessary if they're not allowed to suppress evidence?
I think, Justice Perry-Gary, you've landed on the exact point that the petitioner would make for that statute. Any other reading of the statute would be absurd. It is... I would also point out that the statute states that suppression motions that are raised during or before the preliminary hearing, including language in more than just simply motions to suppress may be appealed, the legislature in 189.120 is recognizing that this is common practice across the state. In fact, the first time that motions to suppress in justice court are addressed, it is 1969. The exclusionary rule, the judicially created exclusionary rule, has been in practice since the 1960s. And prosecutors at that time are asking for a remedy in case there is an erroneous determination of that some evidence should be suppressed. The legislature granted them that at that time, essentially adopting and accepting the notion that justice courts would be hearing motions to suppress, would be weighing the legality of evidence and the constitutionality.
No, and they just apparently created a procedure, in which those determinations could be challenged via Goldsmith and Cook.
Yes, Justice Perry-Gary, they did. And I think that statute lays out that there are multiple remedies for a prosecutor in a position where a Fourth Amendment issue is raised in justice court, the first, of course, being an appeal to the justice court.
Is Cook versus State no longer law in this state?
I believe Cook versus State, Your Honor, or Justice Sherry, was overturned by or superseded by the legislature passing a statute. In Cook, this court was concerned about the rising volume of appeals or writs coming from suppression issues decided in district court, and ultimately determined that that path would no longer be available to litigants to come from the district court up to the Supreme Court. In passing, the legislature did ultimately pass, I believe it is NRS 117.015, which superseded the ruling in Cook v. State.
Do you have to, if the state loses in justice court on a motion to suppress, and they don't appeal it to the district court, and then the trial, you have a pretrial motion to, do you have to file a pretrial motion to suppress again? Even though you won in the justice court?
No.
Over.
Justice Cherry, I would oppose that it's over. Once the justice court ruling has been made, it is binding unless challenged by the state. I would address one of the issues that the court indicated it had concerns about or was interested in hearing, specifically whether or not motions to suppress should be put into writing to avoid any surprise to the state if raised at just in the justice court level. First, I would point out that the argument that prosecutors of the state is often surprised by a Fourth Amendment argument in the middle of a justice court preliminary hearing is an argument that ultimately does not hold water. There are multiple remedies already for a prosecutor in that situation. If, as we have in this case, there is a witness that is an essential witness that is missing, this court's decision in Bustos allows the prosecutor to ask for a continuance to ensure that that ruling is not made. Secondly, it is common practice for justice courts, when asked sometimes by the defense and sometimes by the prosecutor, to allow for briefing of the issue before a probable cause determination. Justice courts do allow for that briefing. Finally, as we've discussed previously, NRS 189.120 does allow the remedy of appeal if the state disagrees with the decision. Also, towards beyond the question of surprise, the idea of filing requiring written motions belies what Judge Dahl was discussing in front of the Nevada legislature. Specifically, he talked about the volume that the justice courts deal with, and that it is slightly more informal than the district court, and that written motions would not necessarily be needed at that point, that the issues are dealt with all the time, and writing is not essential. In addition, as I previously mentioned, the prosecutor would have the option of stopping the argument essentially before the determination of probable cause and asking for a briefing if necessary.
Chewing into your rebuttal time pretty good. You want to save the rest?
I will. Thank you, Justice.
Okay.
As you approach, counsel, I want you to do so with this question in mind. If we were to ignore the statute, which some would suggest provides a remedy to consider or reconsider a motion to suppress at the justice court level, if we were to ignore the two attempts by the Dealers Association to take what you are asking this court to consider today and make it a part of statutory law, how can at least I feel comfortable that you would ask a justice court judge to make a determination of probable cause based upon something that may very well be unconstitutional? That is particularly troubling to me. And I believe if you say they don't have the jurisdiction to consider a motion to suppress, that is precisely what you are doing.
Okay. May it please the court, Mark DiGiacomo, I represent the state of Nevada. I can address all of those issues, hopefully, for the court. And I would like to start with backwards, because they cited State v. Justice Court. And, you know, we are all a system of governments that is established by our Constitution, in which we've all said that the Justice Court has the authority which is conferred upon them by statute. And there is no statute that expressly confers the authority. So where are we at? Potentially, you could address some implied, which the court has already said, you can't imply the authority of a justice court. So where are we at? Let's start with 189.120. Think about why 189.120 was established. It was established in 1969 in the legislature because the prosecutors went up there and said, we need a remedy for that justice court rules on motion to suppress. And what did they do? They passed a remedy. Now, on December 17th of 1969, this court came down, and as far as I can figure out, this ends the discussion. You cannot attack the constitutionality of a piece of evidence on a probable cause hearing on writ. If it is not relevant to the probable cause determination on writ, then what are we doing here at this point? The Supreme Court said in Cook, and I realize the procedure was superseded by statute, but in Robertson, you said it again, the constitutionality of a piece of evidence. So essentially what the court would be left with is, in justice court, I can present a piece of evidence that may or may not be constitutionally infirm. And really, that's the question in this case, right? You have no idea whether or not it was a lawful arrest or not a lawful arrest. Why? Because it's not relevant to probable cause. But you don't know the answer to that. LaCourie Grace's argument was, you don't know why I was arrested on my probation violation, and you have to establish why I was arrested on my probation violation in order for you to get the drugs in evidence, or drugs that were found on my person, into evidence, which we all know is not true. In fact, the irony of that would be what? That in a justice court proceeding on probable cause, we'd be presenting something, i.e., the circumstances of the warrant of arrest, that the defense would argue is inadmissible under 48045 subsection 2 as a bad act in the jury trial. So you'd be requiring us to prove at preliminary hearing something which we wouldn't be proving at trial. There is no implied right to hear the motion to suppress. But more importantly, what you'd be saying is, Mr. Prosecutor, you can go to the grand jury. You can present constitutionally infirm evidence at the grand jury, but you can't do it in front of the justice of the peace. Does that make any sense in our system of governments that we have? No. The answer is absolutely unequivocally no. And the legislature has established in the method that they have established for the procedures here two separate statutes, not one. Two, it says this motion must be made in the trial court, and there must be an evidentiary hearing. I mean, because that's the real irony in this case. Because had there been an evidentiary hearing as required by the statute, then there would have been the witness brought in to establish whether or not the warrant of arrest was valid. But that's not the purpose of probable cause. As the court said in Parsons, it's why you don't address the constitutionality of the prior convictions for a DUI or a DV. Why? Because it's not relevant to the probable cause determination. That is something that will be litigated in district court, the court of general jurisdiction.
So your point is 189.120 doesn't allow the preliminary injunction, preliminary hearings.
It does not create the jurisdiction in the justice court to handle a motion to suppress. The only thing 189.120 does on its face is provide a remedy to the state. And I have the same question Justice Cherry has, which is, let's say in this case it was suppressed and we didn't appeal it. Now I go to the grand jury and I indict Mr. Grace. Is at the jury trial upon Mr. Grace's, the motion to suppress that was ruled upon in another proceeding, admissible or inadmissible, the drugs themselves, in that case? And the question is, I have no idea. Why? Because the statute that says that it's not admissible in any other hearing or proceeding is in the one in which it requires the motion be made in front of the trial court.
So doesn't that put the defense attorney in a box if they have to make a motion before the justice court?
I don't know what box that they would have to be put in. What happened here is we went for a hearing on probable cause, at the end of which they argued a motion to suppress. So in other words, is every determination of probable cause also an evidentiary hearing on any potential Fourth Amendment issue in the case? I don't see that statute anywhere that authorizes that in justice court at all. There is absolutely no authority whatsoever to be addressing this issue at that time. I recognize that, despite there being two statutes that justify it, 50 years of case law, and absolutely no express authority, that the court doesn't like the idea of the possibility of a constitutionally infirm piece of evidence being utilized for probable cause. But I think the court needs to look at what the exclusionary rule is for in order to make that policy consideration. The exclusionary rule is a remedy that usually allows less evidence of guilt to be presented in a case in order to punish the police officers. Do we really think that rule is going to be more effective if it's a justice of the peace or a district court that's making a ruling on the exclusion? The answer is no.
But I need to go back to 189.120. You said it was enacted primarily to assist the DA. Did I hear that right?
It was to provide a remedy for rulings by the justice of the peace. It came out before this court said in Cook that the determination of constitutional and evidence at a preliminary hearing is irrelevant, right? Because you packet it writ.
So then, does it necessarily follow then that 189 is talking about jurisdiction that the justice court doesn't have in the first place?
Well, it's giving me a right to file an appeal. Without a statute, I have no right to file an appeal. Right? So nothing in that statute waives my right to raise jurisdiction as my first ground of appeal, which is what I did in this particular case. Because my very first ground was, wait a second, there is no jurisdiction for the justice of the peace to rule this way. Secondly, he didn't hold an evidentiary hearing, and even if he hadn't held an evidentiary hearing, hearsay is admissible on rulings of the Fourth Amendment, so he should have taken the officer's word that there was a warrant of arrest for the subject that had the drugs taken out of his shoe or his person, wherever it was taken from, because at an evidentiary hearing, the hearsay was admissible. At a preliminary hearing, the hearsay is not admissible, but on an evidentiary hearing on the Fourth Amendment issue, hearsay is admissible. So why did the justice of the peace suppress this particular evidence? That was my
question. Isn't that really the narrow ground on that this case turns on? I mean, that's what I've been wondering, too. Everybody's engaged on jurisdiction to hear a suppression motion, but if hearsay is admissible, and that was my understanding, to determine the constitutional issue, why could you not just say, the guy told me whatever he told me about this arrest?
Well,
was that proffer made?
It was done.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, you don't have to say, if there is a warrant of arrest, then the search incident to arrest, the warrant of arrest gave the authority to the officer to make the arrest. Their argument was there was no evidence of there being a warrant of arrest. Well, there was, but it was only hearsay. That was
the hearsay can be considered, I thought, as a predicate.
It could have, and that was one of the grounds we raised on. The only reason we are here today is because they raised Judge Herndon's findings of fact and conclusions of law, and this is an area that has been of great concern because some justice courts think they have the authority, some justice courts think they don't have the authority.
I understand it's of concern, but I mean, we don't just lightly go into...
I agree with the court 100%. You could dispose of this simply with the JP made a mistake,
okay,
not considering the hearsay. Either way,
going back to Cook, and the legislative fix on Cook was, from what I understand, the JP makes a determination, it goes to the district court makes its determination, and then it's written.
Well, no. The way that the statute is written is that that under Robertson and post-Cook, the statute, which I think they said 117, I think it's 171 or
185. Yeah.
What it says is the motion may be made in front of the court of the trial court.
Right.
And so the statute required it to be made in the district court. Then the defense has an adequate remedy of law, and we have the remedy of 189-120. If a district court were to suppress it, we have the right to appeal within 48 hours or 5 days, depending on what scenario is faced, to this court, which is now the Court of Appeals. The legislative fix to this was not to provide jurisdiction to the justice of the peace. The legislative fix was actually to require it to be made in front of the trial court. And we can all agree that felony and gross misdemeanors are before the trial court is only the district court.
If you don't appeal, are you forever barred as a DA from bringing up? Let's say you get some new evidence and you want to relitigate the motion to suppress.
I have no idea because there's absolutely no case law nor there is a statute. The statute says that if the trial court makes this finding, that it may not be used in any other proceeding. But we can all agree that the justice of the peace isn't the trial court. So that statute that precludes me from using it shouldn't be enacted. But I have no idea because there's no authority, because there's no granting of authority to even hold the suppression motion in front of the justice of the peace.
Is this case just limited to a motion to suppress, or does it apply to an informed confession, and does it apply to a violation of privilege, such as husband-wife privilege or whatever? In other words,
how
do you limit this case?
It depends on which It depends on the nature of the allegation. For example, this court has said an involuntary confession or a confession in violation of Miranda cannot be addressed on writ. So that's a Fifth Amendment issue. Now, if it's an issue and it's spousal versus attorney-client, those are actually within the evidence code, and you've applied the evidence code to preliminary hearing. So I think the court rules that a justice of the peace can rule upon evidence which is admissible. But we can all agree that constitutional rules and constitutional rights are not a rule of evidence, and they've never been held to be a rule of evidence. It's a remedy to a prophylactic remedy to try and prevent the police officers from violating rights of future individuals. That's not an evidentiary rule. It's not a foundational requirement. So I would say that if it were a fourth or a fifth, or potentially a sixth, if there was a right to counsel that it attached, I would say that any one of those issues are issues that have to be addressed in district court, because there's a statute on that as well. Any motion to suppress, it is after indictment or information, but before trial, and it must be made 10 days before trial. That's in Chapter 174. It is structured in such a way that the motion to suppress must be filed in district court. It's the way the statutes are written. And there's no real way around it other than to say, maybe we could infer or imply jurisdiction, which isn't allowed from a statute 189-120, or maybe we can rely upon the legislative history of two statutes that didn't pass. That's all there is.
Judge Herndon's order was too broad when, if you read it to say that justice courts lack the authority to exclude evidence during a preliminary hearing. In other words, that's not his order, or is it?
Well, I think maybe we're reading that too well. They have the authority to exclude evidence at a preliminary hearing. They cannot exclude it based upon constitutional infirmity. That would be certainly what his order intended, but certainly that was what his ruling here was, is the justice of the peace should not have been ruling on their request to suppress the evidence for multiple reasons, one of which is he didn't hold the evidentiary hearing, but had he held the evidentiary hearing, the hearsay would have been admissible. And two, there was no motion as required by the statute, 10 days, it says, before trial or hearing, in order for everyone to address that. I mean, ultimately, the issue here for this court is every preliminary hearing also the evidentiary hearing on a motion to suppress for any constitutional violation? And that answer has got to be no after what you've said in Parsons and all those other cases. The only two cases you've addressed that a JP can do that is in Salas Cooper and the one that I can't say that Aguirre Chia, but both of which involve misdemeanor cases, which of course they have the authority because the statute grants them that authority to be the trial court in a misdemeanor.
But Mr. DiGiacomo, you've given a very nice explanation of how this would work if it were laid out properly. I don't see that in the district judge's order, where he laid out exactly what you've just said. I would agree with Justice Cherry that it's pretty broad. And do we need to correct just even that bit of no evidence? I mean, that is to tie the hands of your JP, right?
Well, I guess the answer to that question is as it relates to a petition on a writ of mandamus, the answer is no. We're all hoping that you will address the jurisdictional issue to give guidance to the justice courts and the district courts. But ultimately, if you find that the evidence was improperly suppressed for whatever reason, whether because there was evidence of probable cause or because there should not have been, then you shouldn't issue an order which reverses an order even if the language is poor. I mean, he may be right for the wrong reasons, but ultimately, if he was right, and it should go back to justice court, this court doesn't need to write on it. It just denies the petition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justices, let me start by saying I think the state has made some excellent points for adding additional procedures to preliminary hearings. However, that's an argument for the legislature. The question in front of you is about the authority for the justice courts to conduct the preliminary hearing, and the authority for the justice of the court, the justice of the peace, to determine whether the evidence was legal or illegal.
You know, he made a good point, and turning these preliminary hearings into full-blown hearings on every matter of suppression, I'm not sure that was contemplated.
I'm not sure that was contemplated either, Justice Perry, but I think it's important to note, as Justice Pickering was asking about what exactly happened here, the record here is that the state never asked for an evidentiary hearing. The state never asked for briefing. The state never asked for a continuance. The state never asked for anything other than an argument that the justice court had no jurisdiction. That was the narrow argument put forward by the state. The state didn't ask for an evidentiary hearing where hearsay might have been admissible. There is a good argument that that might have been within their right, but that's not the question in front of the court today. The question in front of the court today, based on Judge Herman's ruling, that illegal evidence based on constitutional infirmity is a collateral matter to a preliminary hearing. What I would point out is Justice Sadie's concerns are at the heart of why the legislature has refused to restrict this. It's not just that the justice courts would be limited in their in terms of their authority and legitimacy by restricting their authority to determine whether evidence is legal or constitutional, but the answer to the question is, practically, defendants in Nevada will remain in jeopardy, or if they are arrested, they will remain in custody for a significantly additional amount of time while the process works through the district court, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days or longer, depending on which county, which court. All of that time based on this hypothetical or this example of illegally obtained evidence. Ultimately, the inherent jurisdiction this court has previously found in blackjack bonding either comes from statute or general power. The Fourth Amendment is a judicially created remedy. While the procedures may not be completely ironed out, I would contend that at this point, the inherent authority is in the justice court's hands, that the Fourth Amendment was never determined to be restricted one way or the other by any court in Nevada or the U.S. Supreme Court. And finally, the legislature has refused every attempt to restrict that authority.
What about his argument that you can bypass preliminary hearing altogether and go to grand jury?
That is a possibility for the prosecutor to use. However, Justice Perry, if I might be prepared to answer, I think the main difference here is this. In a grand jury, there is no elected judge sitting weighing the facts and weighing the legality of the facts. There is a review afterwards. But Judge Goodman's order in this case specifically says, if there is no authority to hear the constitutionality or legality of the evidence, justice courts in Nevada, justice court judges become nothing more than blind, deaf, and dumb monkeys clapping cymbals for the prosecutor.
Very good. That's a good way to end. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. This case will stand submitted.